following sermon is from Faith Bible Church, located in Murrieta, California. More information about Faith Bible Church is available at www.faith-bible.net.
Well, preparations for church events certainly take a lot of planning, agreed? I know when the high schoolers and the junior highers go out to camp, there's a lot of planning that takes place, and the team that does that is awesome. The ladies' events that we put on from time to time, Megan Woodsum and her team of ladies are just awesome, and they work really, really hard. It takes a lot to put those events together, and we have great servants here at FBC, and they do it every time, willingly, sacrificially, and they just love it. Even Sunday mornings, you know, to sit up here every Sunday morning is a big job. You know that, right? The seats, the music, the team that put, you know, come up and lead us in praise, they're great, aren't they? And they do that out of their, just they love the church, they love the Lord, they want to serve, they do a wonderful job. Everything takes a lot of work, though. We know this. Anything that's good is going to take a lot of preparation. Lack of preparation can have dire consequences. So I remember a few years ago, there was a dangerous men's event where they were shooting guns or something, and someone had decided, you know, to get the lunch together. It was like five kinds of meat, but someone forgot the utensils. So the guys are out there in the middle of nowhere with meat and nothing to eat it with, and I went, well, I was guys, so they made do, you know, it was all right. When I was 9 years old, my parents gave me a racing car set for Christmas, and it was one of the greatest gifts ever. I think I've got a picture of well, there it is. Do you remember this racing car set? This is years ago. I mean, it was an awesome gift, though, and except that my parents forgot to purchase batteries, and there's no power cable for this thing, and so I needed, you know, four D-size batteries in order to play with my racing car set. But, you know, it's Christmas Day, it's 1978, and there are no stores open on Christmas Day in New Zealand. In fact, the next day is Boxing Day, there's no stores open on the 26th either, so I had to wait two whole sleeps to play with my racing cars, and it was like, this was terrible, it was the worst gift ever. My parents' lack of preparation had dire consequences. It was a nightmare. I think most of you wives probably will love it when your husbands surprise you with a surprise getaway, like a holiday, that kind of thing. But the first thing that comes into your mind is, what do I need? What should I be taking? Do I have the right shoes? Do I have the right blouse, you know? And for me, will the hotel have a hairdryer? Something like that. And so we get concerned about these things. We want to be, you know, getaways are much better when preparations are made. Agreed? It always is. And of course, there are times when the consequence of unpreparedness is far more serious, like 75 years ago when the U.S. forces at Pearl Harbor were far from prepared. December 7th, 1941, the Japanese launched a surprise attack, and almost 2,500 people died that day because we weren't ready. It was a terrible tragedy that had terrible consequences, but I got to tell you, as bad as that was, the absolutely worst thing that anybody could ever be unprepared for is the coming of Jesus Christ. That is the event that you want to be ready for. If a person is not ready when Christ comes, there are going to be dire, eternal consequences. It's the most important event in life, and it involves our ultimate preparation. Agreed? The coming of Christ is so, so important. And actually, Christ is the one that tells us so, and he tells us that in Matthew 25. So I want you to go there, take your Bibles, and turn to Matthew chapter 25, and it's really the first 13 verses of that chapter that we'll be looking at this morning. Jesus tells his disciples there a parable. It's a story, and it's meant to motivate them to always be ready for his return. And I think especially as we today are entering into 2017, this is going to be especially helpful for us as we remind ourselves to be ready at all times to meet Jesus Christ, because he could come back at any moment. True? He could come back today. And the question for us is, are we ready? So to set the stage here, I want you just to turn back a page or two, go to chapter 24, and look there at verse 3, chapter 24, verse 3, and the disciples here are asking Jesus a question. He had been talking about the future judgment of Jerusalem and explaining to them what was going to take place, and his disciples, they ask him, and they say, when will these things happen? And what will be the sign of your coming at the end of the age? And they wanted to know when to expect these things. They wanted to know what was going to take place when the world comes to an end. And so Jesus really is answering their question here, and he does that by telling a series of parables. And here in Matthew 25, that's our passage this morning, we have just one of those parables, and I want to take a look at it. In fact, I want to divide our time into three parts. I want to look first at the telling of the parable, and then we'll look at the timing of the parable, and then lastly, we'll look at the teaching of the parable. And you want to take some notes, get the handout there, and follow along as we go through this passage. First, we'll start with the telling of the parable. Now, this is Jesus speaking, and we'll start there in chapter 25, verse 1, and this is what he says. He says, then the kingdom of heaven will be comparable to 10 bridesmaids who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. Now, what I want to do is try to make some observations as we go through each verse. So here in verse 1, you have Jesus describing the kingdom of heaven, and he says it will be comparable. In other words, he's talking about what the kingdom will be like sometime in the future. This is a description of a future kingdom. And he says that this future kingdom is going to be like 10 bridesmaids. Now, some of your translations, depending on which one you have, may identify these as 10 virgins. That's okay, but the fact that they are virgins is not really what's important here. What's important is that these are 10 young single girls who are involved in a wedding ceremony, in a procession. They are bridesmaids, and they are looking forward to the coming of the bridegroom. They're going to be in a wedding. What's more exciting than that? And you'll notice here, if you glance over the entire section, that the bride is not even mentioned in the story. The bride is not there. Well, that's okay. We don't really need to know about the bride. The strength of this story doesn't depend on the bride at all, because the bridegroom is the focus here. He is the central figure, and so we'll focus our attention on him. So, in verse 1, there are 10 bridesmaids, and they are all looking forward to the bridegroom who, according to Jewish custom, the custom of that day, he would soon leave the bride's home in a great procession, and he would move towards his own home where the final parts of the wedding festivities would be concluded. And so these 10 girls here, they have their lamps with them because it's nighttime, and the lamps or torches would be needed to light the way once that procession comes through, the bridal party makes its way from one home to the next. They will need those lamps to light the way. And so they go out then to meet the bridegroom. Look at verse 2. It says here in verse 2, five of the bridesmaids were foolish and five were wise. Five were foolish, five were wise. What does that mean? What is foolishness and what is wisdom? Well, generally speaking, throughout the Bible, wisdom and foolishness have very little to do with knowledge and intellect, or lack thereof. Wisdom and foolishness have everything to do with action, not education. And what I mean by that is this. Foolish people are those who know what to do and what? And don't do it. Wise people are those who know what to do and actually do it. And so here we have five of each. Five foolish bridesmaids who knew what to do and didn't do it, and five wise bridesmaids who knew what to do and actually did it. Look at verse 3. For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them. What a stupid thing to do. I mean, everyone knows that a lamp needs oil. Even we know that, and we don't even use lamps today. If you don't bring oil for your lamp, it's like bringing a flashlight with no batteries. It's like setting out on a long road trip without putting gas in the tank. These foolish girls didn't take their task seriously. They didn't plan ahead with appropriate action. They only made partial preparations. They knew they needed oil, but they just didn't bring any. They knew what they needed to do, but they didn't actually do it. They were fools. And then look at verse 4. But the wise took oil and flasks along with their lamps. See, the wise girls, they planned ahead. They were prepared. They knew that their torches needed oil, and so they got some. They knew what they needed to do, and they actually did it. They were wise. Now look at verse 5. While the bridegroom was delaying, the bridesmaids all got drowsy and began to sleep. I want you to notice here that it was all 10 bridesmaids who went to sleep. In fact, if you look at the parable here so far, you'll notice that the 10 bridesmaids were similar in very many respects. Think about this. All 10 girls intended to meet the bridegroom. Agreed? All 10. They all brought their own lamps. All 10 of them. They all looked forward to taking part. They all thought they were in the wedding party. And here in verse 5, they all fall asleep when the groom is delayed. So many similarities. The 10 are exactly the same. In verse 7, we'll get there in just a moment, they all wake up and prepare their lamps when the groom becomes ready. I just want you to log that observation away for just a bit, put that away for later. These 10 bridesmaids are very similar in so many respects. Now, Jesus doesn't tell us why the bridegroom is delayed. He gives us no hint, and it doesn't really matter because we know even today it's the prerogative of bridal parties to take their own time, right? I mean, they work to their own timetable, and everyone else is meant to just fall in line with what they want to do. We get that. One thing is true, though, with all of this extra time, and there was a lot of time, the unprepared girls should have taken that opportunity to go out and get some what? Some oil. They had time to do it. And they didn't. They had no attempt here to remedy their situation at all. So in verse 6, at midnight, there was a shout. Behold, the bridegroom, come out to meet him. See here, there's no warning, just a sudden call to action. All of the bridesmaids were now expected to do their duty. And in verse 7, it says, then all those bridesmaids rose and trimmed their lamps. They all spring into action. Even the foolish, unprepared girls are excited. They're jumping up and down with joy. They're thrilled that the time has finally come and they want to be involved in this ceremony. So they jump to their feet. But lo and behold, look at verse 8. The foolish girls said to the wise girls, give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out. And it's only now, after all of that wasted time and wasted opportunity, that these foolish bridesmaids even think about oil. They knew they needed it. At the beginning of the day, But they didn't bother bringing any oil for themselves. So now they're out there desperately trying to get some oil from those who had come prepared. Now listen, one point of clarification here. It's not that the foolish girls started with enough oil and then ran out because the bridegroom was delayed. That's not what's happening here. The point of the story is that they didn't have oil in the first place. They didn't come prepared. They should have been ready for the groom. Whether he was short in coming or long in coming, they should have been prepared for every eventuality, but they weren't. So they're out there, they're trying to get oil from others, but look here in verse 9, the wise girls, they answer, and they say, no, there will not be enough for us and you too. Go instead to the dealers and buy some for yourselves. These wise girls are really strong here, aren't they? They're like, no, this is our oil. You can't have any. You need to go and get your own. And at first glance, it just seems a little bit mean, doesn't it? A little bit mean that why, I'm like, why can't they just share their oil? But you know what? The wise bridesmaids, they're not looking out for themselves. They're looking out for the bridegroom who is depending upon them. This is not a selfish decision. This is not five mean girls keeping out the five unfortunate girls. This is actually a further manifestation of the wisdom of the five bridesmaids who actually had the groom's interests at heart. They're looking out for him. And they know that if they try to share, that actually they'll all run out and then the ceremony would come to a sudden halt. So they're not going to do that. They tell these girls to go and get their own oil, but it's midnight. And where can you buy oil at midnight? It's like when you have an In-N-Out fix at 2 a.m. and they're closed. Like you're not going to satisfy that fix at 2 a.m. And in this case, at least it's going to be really, really hard or take a long, long time to find that oil. And so in verse 10, while they're going away to make the purchase, the bridegroom came and those who were ready went in with him to the wedding feast. And then the door was what? Shut. The word that's used here indicates that that door was shut to stay shut. Only the prepared bridesmaids were allowed to enter. Only those who were found ready for the groom went in. The unprepared girls, who didn't show any foresight whatsoever, the ones who didn't show any real concern for the bridegroom, they were shut out of the festivities forever. Now, they protested. I mean, they wanted in, and this is what's so sad, because they felt like they should be included. They really believed that they qualified for entry, and they argued that they should be let in. Look here at verse 11. Later, the other bridesmaids also came saying, Lord, Lord, open up for us. See, they're pleading with the groom to gain entry, and they say, Lord, Lord, which, by the way, tells us that they understood who was in control here. They understood that it was the bridegroom who made the rules in this situation. They knew that their lives were under the control of the bridegroom, and so they addressed him as Lord, their master. But look at this in verse 12. He answered to them, and he said, truly I say to you, I do not know you. Whoa, what a shock. What a shock. The Lord says, no, you're not getting in here. I don't even know who you are. Who are you people? And it's somewhat reminiscent, isn't it, of Matthew 7, the Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus is preaching there and he explains to that great crowd on the mountain, he says to them, you know, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. But he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven will enter. And then he explains what he means. He says, many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? And in your name cast out demons, and in your name perform many miracles. These were religious people who did amazing things. And they think that their amazing actions should get them into the heaven, the kingdom of heaven. And Jesus says to them in verse 23, he says, I'll declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. How sad is that? That is a sad, sad day. But it's very clear, isn't it? But on that day, that many people who think they are headed right in to heaven are going to be shocked to hear that Jesus doesn't even know who they are. And despite all their good deeds, all of their religious actions, all of their partial preparations and supposed Christian service, Jesus only sees them as people who practice lawlessness. That's how he sees them. And he says it with finality here. See that phrase there in verse 12? He says, truly, I say to you. And it carries the force of a judicial verdict. This is the master who is not going to change his mind. There's not going to be an opportunity to appeal this decision. There are no second chances. And he says, I don't know you, which is not so much a literal statement of non-acquaintance, but this is a statement of disassociation. For the Lord disassociates with these foolish bridesmaids because they never got themselves ready for his arrival. They wanted to be in. They wanted to get into that wedding procession. They counted themselves within the group of the bridesmaids. They probably even, when you think about it, they probably had good relationships and friendships with the other bridesmaids. All 10 of them would have been friends. They thought they knew the groom. They really believed that they should get in, but they didn't bother to take his arrival seriously. They didn't bother to get ready, and now the Lord says, I don't even know you. This is a moment of sheer terror. Can you imagine being in that situation? When the five girls realize they've been foolish. They should have been ready, but they weren't. And then comes verse 13. And here we find the moral of the story. Jesus says, be on the alert then, for you do not know the day nor the hour. In other words, be prepared. You don't know when the Lord's coming back, so be continually prepared. Be in a state of readiness always. Listen, folks, when it comes down to it, a lack of foresight is inexcusable. Does that make sense? We need to be continually prepared. On that day, ignorance will not be a defense for neglect. We won't be able to claim ignorance. That's the point of the whole parable here. And this is the main command in the passage. Be ready, be alert, be prepared. And by the way, it's got nothing to do with staying awake. You understand that, right? All 10 bridesmaids were asleep when that call came. Sleeping is not the issue here, but being prepared when the time comes, that's the issue. Jesus said it in chapter 24, verse 42. He said, be on the alert, for you do not know which day your Lord is coming. Be on the alert. And then again in verse 44, for this reason, you also must be ready. The Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think he will. You say, when is he coming? He's coming at a time when you don't think he will. That's when he's coming. No one knows when the Son of Man, the bridegroom, is going to return, but we better be ready. Now that's the story. It's a challenging story, isn't it? It's a good story. And the point of the story is pretty clear. It's this: some people who think they know Jesus really do, and some people who think they know Jesus really don't. That's the point of the story. But I got to say, there's an interpretive question here that needs to be answered. I want to dig deep. I want you to track with me here. The question is this: to whom does this passage really apply? That's the question. Who is Jesus describing by this parable? We know who the bridegroom is, right? That's Jesus. That's pretty easy to understand, to figure that out. But who exactly are these 10 girls? Who do they represent? And to answer that question, I want us to look back for a moment at the timing of the parable. That's where we are, the timing of the parable. When should this parable be applied? That's the question. And I want us to look at the context here of the story to figure this out, because the parable of the 10 bridesmaids is located inside a longer sermon. Jesus is preaching a sermon from chapter 24 all the way to the end of chapter 25. And I want to show you where this all begins. So let's go back to 24, okay? Go there with me. The day is just a few days before the crucifixion of Christ. And Jesus has been in Jerusalem and he's been preparing himself and the people for his death and resurrection, which is about to take place. And look here in verse 1, chapter 24, verse 1. Jesus came up out from the temple and was going away when his disciples came up to point out the temple buildings to him. And he said to them, "Do you not see all these things? Truly, I say to you, not one stone here will be left upon another which will not be torn down." It's an interesting statement. But that statement right there would have been a total shock to his disciples. That would have just blown them away, because they fully expected Jesus, their Messiah, to set up his kingdom in Jerusalem in their lifetime. And here he is telling them that this temple is going to come down and be destroyed. So this prophecy about the destruction of Jerusalem would have been a huge shock to them. They've been hanging out with him, waiting for the kingdom to come. Like they wanted to be a part of it. They wanted to be part of the whole glory of that kingdom. And now he's saying, no, everything's going to be destroyed. And so in verse 3, he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, and the disciples came to him privately saying, "Well, tell us, when will these things happen? And what will be the sign of your coming at the end of the age?" And Jesus is sitting there on the Mount of Olives. If you remember the scene, it's the Mount of Olives, and then there's a valley, and then across the way, there's Jerusalem with a temple right there. And they can see the temple right in front of them. And the disciples are saying, when is that temple going to be destroyed? And Jesus preaches a sermon on the Mount of Olives. It's called the Olivet Discourse. And it goes all the way from chapter 24 to 25. You want to read the whole thing this afternoon. But this is what he says. And remember this. This is Jesus telling the disciples what will be the sign of his coming again. He's explaining this. And let me give you a summary version. In verse 5, he says to them, "A time is coming when some people will claim to be Christ." They will claim to be the Messiah, but don't believe them. And then in verse 6, he says, there's going to be wars, but don't worry, because that's not yet the end. And then in verse 7, he says there's going to be wars and famines and earthquakes. And in verse 8, he says all of this is just the start. This is just merely the beginning of birth pains, because things are going to get much, much worse after this. Then look at verse 15. It says in verse 15, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place," let the reader understand, "then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains." Now stop right there. What is this abomination of desolation? What is this thing that Daniel described way back in the Old Testament? Well, Daniel described a day when a powerful man would come to Jerusalem, and he would break a 7-year contract with the Israelite nation. He would break the contract halfway through that agreement. He would actually end up destroying the city and leaving Jerusalem desolate. This is all in Daniel chapter 9. You can read this. He would desecrate the temple by sacrificing a pig, an unclean animal, on the altar, and he would greatly offend the Jews. He would set himself up as God, and he would demand to be worshipped by the people. This is what this great, powerful man would do. And he would set about to murder and eradicate the whole Jewish nation. Try to kill them all. Revelation 13 explains that these events are going to take place in a future 7-year-long tribulation, which has still yet to happen. We haven't seen this yet. It's still future, even today. So Jesus is telling his disciples about this. And he's telling them that this Antichrist, the imposter, is going to come and start a war against Israel. And if anyone is in Judea or Jerusalem at that time, they better flee to the mountains. They better escape right away. Otherwise, they'll lose their lives. And then look at verse 21. He says, "For then there will be a great tribulation such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will. A great tribulation is going to occur like nothing we have ever seen on this world ever before." Now remember, the disciples are getting more than they asked for. They're just like, "Well, when is this going to happen?" And Jesus is explaining all of this. And he's answering that question, when are these things going to take place? Then after these events, look at this in verse 29. Verse 29, "But immediately after the tribulation of those days, after those 7 years, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars, probably meteors, will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken." You know, the planets as we know them, the stars, the meteors, asteroids, they will all have their flight plan altered. Nothing will be the same. And then here in verse 30, "Then, after all of that, then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man," that's Jesus, "coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory." Jesus Christ is going to come back to this earth after the tribulation. Does that make sense? 7 years of destruction and judgment on this earth, and then he's going to come back. And at that time, there's going to be two groups of people on the earth. It's going to be Jews, they're going to be Gentiles. And both groups will receive judgment from the Son of Man, from Jesus. And those judgments are described in Matthew 24 and 25. That's why you need to read it when you get home this afternoon, or two chapters. According to those two chapters, he's going to judge, firstly, the Jews by three criteria. Let me give them to you. First criteria is their stewardship of Christ's resources. That's what the parable of the two servants teach us in chapter 24. Second criteria, he's going to judge the Jews according to their preparedness. Were they prepared for the Messiah? And that's the parable that we're looking at this morning, the parable of the 10 bridesmaids. And then third criteria, he will judge them according to their faithfulness. That's what the parable of the talents teach in chapter 25, the verses following our passage. So that he's going to judge the Jews according to those three criteria. And then he moves to the Gentiles, and he judges them according to how they treated the Jews in the tribulation. And that is the story of the sheep and the goats' judgment in chapter 25. So, With all that in mind, I hope you're tracking with me. With that in mind, what does it mean then for our parable today? That's the question. What does it mean for the parable of these 10 bridesmaids? It means this. If you look at the whole context, Jesus is not describing today. He's describing a future day when he's going to return. At first, there'll be a 7-year period of judgment when God tries to get the attention of his chosen nation, Israel. And after that tribulation time, Jesus is going to return to earth. But when he comes, it's going to be a huge surprise. I mean, no one will know that it's going to happen. And like the 10 sleeping bridesmaids, the nation of Israel is going to be taken by surprise when the bridegroom finally comes. Once they've been aroused from their sleep, some Jews will be found ready, and some Jews will not be found ready. So who exactly are these 10 bridesmaids? That was our original question, right? They are Jews living at the time of that future 7-year tribulation. Some of the Jews will be ready for their Messiah, some of them will not. And Jesus, by the way, he's telling his disciples all of this to motivate them to be ready for his return. So here's the question for us, because we're not living in Judea, and most of us are not Jews. There may be some here, but most of us aren't. We live in Southern California, 2017. How does this parable then apply to us? Because if it's all about Jews in a future time, then maybe we should just close our Bible and close in prayer and go home. Or is there something here for us? I think there is. I think that the same reminder for Jews to be ready for their Messiah applies to us in similar ways by extension. Now, Matthew 25 is a warning to future Jews, but we need to hear an admonition here too. Listen, we may not, as mostly a Gentile audience, we may not be waiting specifically for the second coming of Christ, but we are waiting to meet Christ, aren't we? And that is going to happen one day. When it happens, it'll happen in either of two ways. Some of us will meet Christ when we die. Some of us will meet Christ in the air when he raptures his church. But either way, it's going to be a surprise. Either way, we still need to be prepared. And so this passage applies to us. It's going to be a shock, but we still need to be ready. So let me try to distill down for you here. This is where we'll finish up. I want to move finally here to the teaching of the parable. Let's try to bring this home. Because how does this apply really to us living in Southern California in 2017? So we've looked at the telling of the parable. We've looked at the timing of the parable. Here we look at the teaching of the parable. What are the implications for you and I? I think there are at least six. Let me list these for you. And by the way, these apply to everyone who is expecting to meet Christ. Are you expecting to meet Christ? These apply to you. Every one of these. Are you ready? Doesn't matter if it's death that takes you to Christ. Doesn't matter if it's the rapture that takes you to Christ. It doesn't matter if you're a future Jew living on that day when Christ comes in the second coming. In either case, these apply. Here we go. Number one, Christ's arrival is greatly anticipated. Christ's arrival is greatly anticipated. Meeting Christ for the very first time, face to face, ought to be thought of as a joyful event, shouldn't it? One that we all greatly anticipate. We should be looking forward to that day. We should want it to happen now. We're excited about this. I mean, it's going to be awesome. It's going to be better than a wedding. Think about that day for those of you who are married, when your wedding day was approaching. You couldn't wait, right? But meeting Christ is even better than that. will see him face to face. I can't wait to meet my closest friend. I can't wait to feel his embrace. And I want it to happen today, don't you? I mean, today would be good. Today would be better than tomorrow. Tomorrow would be okay as well. But now, we want to see Jesus, and we ought to be talking about it all the time. We ought to be joyful and excited and pumped up that we are going to meet Jesus. It's going to be awesome. Number two, Christ's delay will be long. It'll be long, just like wedding parties take their time. They seem to have their own schedule. So too, Christ has his own timetable here. And only the Father knows the day and the hour. Just the Father. And listen, it's been 2,000 years so far, but don't be discouraged. And I've got to tell you, don't be wooed into some false sense of security, thinking that it's still going to be a way off. His delay may be long, but he is going to come. That is for sure. That is guaranteed. And when he comes, number three, Christ's return will be sudden. It'll be sudden. No warning. There may be some general signs. We might have a general idea, maybe. But when it comes down to the day and the hour, no one knows. No one. It's going to be unexpected. It'll take us by surprise. There will be no chance to make last-minute preparations. Can't do it. It will shock you when it happens, because number four, Christ's salvation can't be transferred. It can't be transferred. Those people who are prepared to meet him can't give you what you need if you're unprepared. They can't do it. No one else will be able to help you. No one can give you their oil. And you won't be able to go out and quickly find some. You won't be able to make those last-minute preparations because the time will be too late. Christ comes, and there is no last-minute rescue. None. Why? Because number five, Christ's judgment will be irrevocable. Once he shuts the door, you cannot find another way in. There is no other way in. You can't buy entrance. You can't barter your way in. You can't appeal to God. His only words to you will be these: depart from me, I don't know you. And he's not going to change his mind. So that takes us to number six. Christ's kingdom is for the prepared. It's for the prepared. Christ's kingdom is only open to those who get themselves ready. Listen to me carefully here. The kingdom of heaven is not open to those who simply respond to some kind of invitation. Because all of the bridesmaids did that. The kingdom of heaven is not for those who simply make some kind of confession. All of the bridesmaids would have said that they were part of the bridal party. Just to say that you're a part of it doesn't mean that you're actually a part of it. The kingdom of heaven is not for those who merely express some affection. All of the bridesmaids would have had positive sentiments toward the bridegroom. The kingdom of heaven is only for those who are prepared and remain prepared until he comes. And the only way, listen, the only way to be ready for Jesus is to be ready always. Always. The Christian life is not a sprint. It's a marathon. You got to make it to the end. It's not a raging bonfire that slowly runs out of heat and eventually peters out to nothing. It's a constant flame that burns for God's glory. It's not a lukewarm love for Christ. It's a burning hot desire to give everything, even your own life, for the sake of Christ. It's not a life that looks outwardly Christian, but it's a transformed heart, isn't it? A heart that really wants to please God. That's a Christian. A Christian is not someone who starts the race only, but he actually finishes the race stronger than when he started. That's a Christian. It's a believer who matures and grows and serves and sacrifices and fights temptation. It's not a person who's always looking for the easy way out. It's a sojourner who is passing through this evil world. It's not a permanent resident who loves his current surroundings and wants to sit around and just enjoy them. No, Christian's looking forward to eternity with Christ. He wants to get out of here. A genuine Christian is not someone who just passes time without serious, and I mean serious, thought and action regarding the coming kingdom of Jesus. You know, John Plesnik said it last week. A genuine Christian invests their life in preparations for eternity. So true. Is that you? Are you ready for Christ to come? Are you prepared to meet him? You know, I talk to people often who claim to be Christians. Most people do. But as I talk to them, they have no assurance of salvation because they are only outwardly righteous, but on the inside, they know that they are just as sinful as ever. They know it. And yet they go on fooling themselves and they're dinking around with church and church people, thinking that everything's okay when it's not. It's not okay. What a sad reality. Who are you? Are you a wise bridesmaid or a foolish bridesmaid? You know, 2 Corinthians 13:5 says, test yourselves to see if you're in the faith. Are you in the faith? Really? Paul says, examine yourselves. We've got to do this, don't we? You want to have full assurance that when that day comes, you walk right into the kingdom of heaven because Jesus Christ knows you. The last thing you want to hear is, depart from me. I don't know you. So do you pass the test? I hope you do. Here's some famous quotes for you. Benjamin Franklin, he said, by failing to prepare, you are preparing to fail. Prepare, folks. Get ready. Vince Lombardi, he said, everyone has a will to win, but very few have a will to prepare to win. And Russell Wilson, he said, the separation is in the preparation. And listen, these guys are talking about insignificant, stupid things, like forming a nation and winning sports games, compared to the kingdom of heaven, right? They are insignificant. Meeting Jesus is way more important than any of that. And so we need to be prepared. Listen, one last verse. Jesus said it himself. He said, for this reason, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think he will. Are you ready? Let's pray.
Thanks for listening today. Sermon audio from the last 3 years is available by podcast, and a larger archive from Chris Mueller and Faith Bible Church can be found at media.faith-bible.net. And if you would, please leave us a review on iTunes. It helps a lot. Thanks, and have a great day.